When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to a bonus episode of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the TLS podcast. Last year, summing up the latest collection of essays by the novelist Zadie Smith, the TLS reviewer Gretchen Gertziner described the work as a clear, many-voiced manifestation of a voracious mind that ranges through the visual arts, literature, philosophy, natural science, race and family. This voraciousness is on show in the clip you're about to hear from a widely reported event recorded earlier this year at Hay Festival in Colombia. In conversation with the journalist Carolina Sanin, Smith explores ideas around localism, servitude and historical luck. She began, though, by discussing her relationship with writing.
I intend to write a perfect 110-page existential novella, and I end up writing a 450-page, heavily populated piece of comic fiction. So it's never what I plan, you know. And I have a great envy for other traditions, but I think one of the truths of being a writer is that you're limited in a certain way by your childhood, by the books that were put in front of you. And I would have been a very different writer if I had grown up in Paris, you know. But I grew up in England, and I read Dickens, and I read Shakespeare, and I read Tolstoy, and everything else that came to me in the way of a more global taste or eclectic taste came later. But it's very hard to be influenced when you're 35, you know? Most of the influence happens when you're 9. And so I was formed by books that, if I could do it again, I wouldn't choose those books. but I can't do it again. So I find writing very difficult in the sense that I have a lot of self-loathing as I write, you know? But I guess what's perhaps unusual is I write through it, yeah.
Yes, well, your novel, as I said, covers the world, and it literally does. It takes place in London and then in Africa and in New York. And it has mostly like this vitality that has to do with the power to travel and to change places, and it's... One thinks of globalization and globality, and when looking at it, but at the same time, it deals with what it means being from somewhere,
right?
Being not localized but local, and having grown up somewhere,
right?
What do you intend to say about not origin but the relationship to place, to a place?
Well, while I was writing Swing Time, I was also writing shorter things, and I wrote a short story which is set in the future, you know, way in the future, a kind of speculative fiction thing. And I realized later when I read the short story is that though it seems from a different universe from Swing Time, the thing which is the same is this idea that to be local in the contemporary consciousness is to be disadvantaged, right? Part of the idea of wealth is that you can move freely, that you're not tied to anything. And in Swing Time, there's a kind of global pop star character who is the kind of physical reality of that. She doesn't live anywhere, she doesn't belong to anywhere, and she considers that her glory, really. And in my science fiction story, it was kind of an extreme version where anybody who's left in a place in the story, in this case England, is the disenfranchised. You know, the people left in this modern England are the people who couldn't get away as the water rose and as this kind of collapse occurs. So I recognize that as a new kind of wealth, just as the same as, you know, if you went to the 17th century, to be fat was to be rich. Now, supposedly, to be fat is to be poor. You know, you have to watch these transformations of values. But I guess when I'm writing, I'm trying to think, trying to resist the idea that these values are reality, you know? They're ideological. And there's a lot to be said for the localized, the rooted, someone who is present in the community, someone who, you know, so much contempt is thrown in the idea of being born, living and dying in the same geographical space. But for thousands of years, that was reality. I was...
It's still reality.
It's still reality for millions of people. And in my own life, I was born and brought up in a council state in northwest London. And then when I made money, when I was young, I bought a house opposite that council estate, which is a classic example of a localized mind, right?
And the other side of the street.
Right, I couldn't imagine anything outside of Willesden. And I can remember being interviewed by journalists at the time, I guess upper middle class journalists, who found it essentially comic what I had done, you know, because... And I grew to be a bit ashamed of it, but then as I got older, I thought, no, you know, that was my vision of a good life, was that neighborhood, my friends, my family. And the contempt which is poured on that vision of a local life or a life with limits, more than anything, is what interested me.
Yeah, the other question would be, of course, if there are some places more local than others.
Right.
If being from London, no matter what neighborhood in London, is the same as being from some corner in the Andes, if you're right. As much as a Londoner as you can be an Andean peasant from that piece of land, you know? But that's another
question.
Well,
I don't think so, because some cities are mythologized. London is one of them. New York, we were just talking backstage, is another one. Even people resident in New York, as I am, frequently feel themselves to be living in a movie. You're not living in a physical space. You're living in layers of ideology and mythology, which can have quite comic effects. You know, quite often when I'm in New York, as we visit each other's apartments, I'm in NYU housing, so I'm rent-controlled like various people in the city. But you can go to the apartment of people earning, you know, the kind of 1%, and their apartment is no bigger than the council estate flat I grew up in. So you know people are living in ideology when they're willing to pay amounts of money that are obscene to even repeat on the stage, to live in a box of the same kind that I grew up in. So for me, that kind of... those extremities make you wonder about even the rationality of that kind of wealth. You know, there's a deep insanity in those situations.
Definitely. There is also a way in which you belong to a time, and that's also one of the topics of your novel,
right.
I think, which is called, ironically, Swing Time, because the novel doesn't take place at that time that we know as
right.
Swing Time. But there are a couple of little girls that then grow up, and they live in that time.
Right.
And the way in which they live in that time is they watch dancing. They dance, but for me the most important part about that activity was watching dancing.
Right.
And so when I was reading the novel, I wondered what makes a time. Like, it's not historical events.
No.
And, or not only, or not necessarily the most important feature, but there is an atmosphere that makes a time feel like that time,
right.
Like swing time. And it may be music, of course, but then there are many periods in history from which you don't have any recordings. And then there is dance, and that's what the novel seems to suggest. There is the way people moved at a particular
right.
time. But I wanted you to talk about the relationship with a period in time that is not your own, but you come from that period of time because you come from all the periods of time that
right.
were before, and that is not nostalgic necessarily. It's an affinity, but...
Right.
Yeah.
It's hard. I mean, nostalgia is a very deep temptation for a writer perhaps particularly for a British writer. What I was trying to get at, and I realize now as I'm older that maybe this was a strange feeling to have as a child, but I always had the sense that being born in 1975 in the place I was born in represented like unprecedented historical luck. I always had that sense. I would read, I used to read the encyclopedias a lot. This is obviously pre-internet. And I remember very keenly looking at pictures of people being disemboweled in London streets in the 1500s as a punishment, being drawn and quartered, which is when you open up the body, take out the guts, and drag a person, usually by a horse, through the streets. And I remember thinking very clearly, wow, I'm glad it's not 1512. I always had that sensation of luck, of historical luck. And of course, it's intensified by your identity, I suppose. Both my parents were from a long line of servants, one way or another. So my father's mother and their family worked in a big house downstairs, and my mother's mother was like an orderly in a hospital. So they came from this long line of profoundly dispossessed people. So my perspective in our estate was very skewed. I really felt rich. I felt really lucky. It was only when I moved out of my childhood and realized there was a scale of richness that I understood where I stood in British life. But in my childhood, I was under an illusion that we were doing really well. we were really living the dream, yeah.
And that scale of richness is infinite, too.
Right, it's like infinite.
Infinitely down and infinitely up it goes, and yeah. And that brings me to the other thing I wanted to talk about with you, which was servitude.
Right.
It seems to me that it's somehow or for some reason very relevant right now. You saw Roma, the film by Cuarón.
Right, yeah.
And then there is the favorite, the Yorgos Lanthimos, right, latest film, also about serving, right, someone else. It's also about two women, one serving the other one, right, actually a triangle of two women serving another one. And in your novel, there's a couple of friends, of female friends, right, that grew up together. And then there is another couple of friends. One of them becomes friends with another woman, but is also her servant, is her personal assistant, right, but that's a name for a servant. And so why do you think it's becoming so relevant as a topic now? Because maybe even more than race and class, right, now we are thinking in terms of master and servant again.
I think, in my view, it's the return of the repressed. So what happened in the 80s and 90s is we convinced ourselves we'd come to, I mean in the West, and particularly in Anglo-American culture, that we'd come to the end of history, that we were in a social democracy in which something which had held true for thousands of years, the existence of servitude and of hierarchies of people, had basically disappeared. I know from living in New York that the servitude, it stopped being in your house, but it, of course, is everywhere. There are nannies and tutors and fitness instructors, and there's around each individual woman in New York, there is this invisible army of people working for her. And the relation is supposedly one of equality. Every now and then we have these monstrous stories in New York, you know, a nanny murdering children or some other rebellion of a servant class, and everybody is suddenly awakened to the realization, oh, this is a city of servitude. In my own life, when I first had children, I'd go into the playground and realize that I, as far as everyone was concerned in the playground, I was another Jamaican nanny. All the nannies are Jamaican. And I'm with these children, and I must be another one of this invisible class. And so then you're in a strange position. Are you meant to assert your, oh, I'm not the servant class. I am the mother in this case, over your sisters, perhaps your cousins, your second cousins. So this kind of invisible servitude, I think, has been deeply repressed. And then, even in practical terms, I wrote a story about an actual slave being kept in a suburban house in Willesden. And that story came from a news article that my mother showed me. I was home, and she said, you know, down the road from us, there was a woman being kept as a slave in this house, with her passport taken from her, with her wages kept. That's a kind of explicit expression of it, but it's also around us all the time. And then I was thinking, too, as I wrote Swing Time, of the servitude of one country to another. And the idea, perfectly obvious idea, that we repress all the time, that when you sit down to dinner, when you get dressed, there is an invisible army of people making these clothes, providing this food, in the case of your iPhones, producing the cobalt, which is in the phone. Children mine that for a few dollars a month. So the thing that we hold as our great symbol of, I don't know, technocratic futurism and liberation is literal servitude in your pocket. It takes a lot, I believe, to not look at that.
Zadie Smith talking to Carolina Sanin at Hay Festival Cartagena. A recording of the full conversation along with the entire Hay Festival archive is available to subscribers to the Hay Player online at hayfestival.org. As for the TLS, we'll be back at Hay Festival in Wales this summer, so go to hayfestival.com for tickets and information.